What went wrong with science? Well, I suppose, first of all, what is science? Science is a discipline which was proposed by Francis Bacon in about 1850, and he was a Christian, and he proposed this because he pointed out that nature carries the stamp of the Creator, whereas man's reason carries the stamp of his own folly. We will have it that all things are as we in our folly think they should be. So we've got two conflicting things here, nature bearing the stamp of the Creator and us liking to believe what we want to believe. So he proposed the scientific method in order to save us from ourselves and keep us looking at God's creation. So, he proposed the scientific method in which the search for knowledge about any phenomenon or process involves 1. Observation and measurement. Without observation and measurement, science doesn't start. Then when you've got sufficient observations and measurements, you search for patterns in the observations and measurements. And you then propose possible explanations to explain those patterns. Then you design critical experiments to test and see whether the hypothesis holds up in situations that you hadn't tried before. And if those experimental results do not support the hypothesis, then you must search for a hypothesis which explains both the old and the new observations and measurements. And if a lot of evidence from your experiments supports a hypothesis and none at all contradicts it, it can be considered a law of science. And if any observation contradicts a hypothesis at any stage, it must be abandoned and a new hypothesis sought. Now, if your investigation follows these rules, then you can call it science. And if it doesn't, you can't. Now, science progressed slowly from Bacon's time up to the Reformation. And at the Reformation, the Bible became available, it was published, and it was available to everybody who wanted to read it. And people gobbled it up. They were really eager for this Bible and they read it. And they found things like this: that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. Now, coupled with this, the assurance that God is to be found in his creation, he can be seen in his creation, we also have passages like Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18, where it says, "Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord." So we see in the Bible a reasonable, law-giving God who has shown himself in his creation. And there was a generation of people eager to know more about the God they read of in the Bible and saw his creation as the way to get closer to him. And science took off as Christians eager to know more about their Creator got to work. Now, perhaps the greatest scientist that ever lived was Isaac Newton, and he was famous for statements like, "This most beautiful system of sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. This being governs all things, not as the soul of the world, but as Lord over all. And a biographer of Newton made the comment, were it not for Newton's God, he would never have gone looking for his laws. Now, Leonhard Euler would probably be considered the greatest science that ever lived by today's standards. Today's standards put your quality as a scientist on the number of papers that you've published. Well, for 50 years, one-third of all the papers published in the world on physics, mathematics, and engineering were written by Euler. And they were all really meaty, brilliant papers. If you really want to give yourself a treat, read some of Euler's papers. They're beautiful. And he was unusual. He may be the only man who ever lived who attended Bible study every day of his life. From the cradle to the grave. When he was in the cradle, his father took the Bible studies. When he grew up and had his own family, he took the Bible studies. When his children grew up, they brought his family every day to his house for the Bible study. When he was old, he went blind. Didn't prevent his Bible studies because he knew the Bible off by heart. And he made this statement that we all ought to take to heart. In our researches into the phenomena of the visible world, we are subject to weaknesses and inconsistencies so humiliating that a revelation was absolutely necessary to us, and we ought to avail ourselves of it with the most powerful veneration. Put in simple language, in doing science, we make such humiliating blunders, we needed the Bible to keep us on the right track. Then we have Gottfried Leibniz, and Leibniz said, it is especially in the scientists, in the sciences, that we see the wonders of God, his power, his wisdom, and goodness. That is why, since my youth, I have given myself to the sciences that I loved. Now, these people that we have looked at, all of them are known as mathematicians and scientists. In fact, the early scientists mainly called themselves mathematicians, because mathematics and science are totally intertwined. Language is the mathematics is the language for dealing with numbers. Science deals with observations and measurements. Those measurements are in numbers. The language that you deal with numbers in is mathematics. So science and maths are intricately intimately intertwined. And as Robert Fisher pointed out, the language of mathematics, which consists of its symbols and their relations, is very much at the heart of all fields of science. If you're not taking observations and measurements, you're not doing mathematics, you're not doing science. And if you're doing science and getting those observations and measurements, you need to analyze them with the most efficient method, which is mathematics. Einstein said, science demands the highest possible standard of rigorous precision in the description of relations, such as only the use of mathematical language can give. Now, it used to be a common saying, mathematics is the most powerful toolbox, the most powerful tool in the scientist's toolbox. And I would say, that is a very true saying. Herbert Dingell was a professor of physics. He was an expert on evolution, on relativity. He wrote books on relativity. But he pointed out a problem. In the language of mathematics, one can tell lies as well as truth, and it can be very difficult to tell one from the other. Now, he wrote this when he had come across the problem of Einstein's relativity. The problem with that is it pushes mathematics to deal with something other than the reality which we live in. And once it deals with a realm that we don't actually live in, we can't see what's right and what's wrong. And he was very concerned because he had a very simple demonstration that Einstein's relativity was not true. And he came to the point of realizing what actually others had realized before him. Scientists have relapsed into imagining how nature ought to behave and then assuming that she does so. You remember the reason why Bacon put forward the reason for the scientific method? Because the creation behaves the way God made it. And we think it should behave the way we want it to behave. And now the mathematicians have gone back to making things work in their mathematics the way they think it should work. And he points out the factor which has made this possible is the exchange of reason for mathematics. Now, in science, you need mathematics as a tool. You cannot replace reasoning with mathematics. Mathematics has become the master of science instead of the servant. Now, why did this happen? Right through history, mathematics and science were intertwined because they were dealing with the same thing. They were dealing with reality. In science, you observe the reality. In mathematics, you try and make sense of your observations about reality. But mathematicians rebelled against working to describe and analyze the Creator's creation. In the 18th century, a great project among the mathematicians arose to free mathematics from the creation. They hated the idea that they were restricted by the Creator to what mathematics could deal with. Secular humanist mathematicians demanded to be autonomous. It's the old story. We want to be like gods. And human nature is such that if you've got the opportunity to be a god instead of rely on the God of creation, then you're easily led that way. And these mathematicians demanded a basis for mathematics which did not rely on the creation, but only on the construction of their own minds. Now, one of the chief protagonists in this was Leopold Kronecker, and he, along with the others, was searching for a basis for mathematics, and after his thorough search, he came to the conclusion that the basics for mathematics is the integers, the counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you cannot get away from that, and they are God-given. So God made the integers, all else is the work of man. Now the next person on the scene in this quest is Georg Cantor, a And he said, Kronecker needs God. I do not. So he built a basis for mathematics on infinity. Now, infinity is not a God-given entity. It is a, well, it's a construct of the mathematician's mind. You can't point to infinity. It is a limit. And in order to actually define what you mean by this limit, which is infinity, it takes an awful lot of words to try and define it. And this was one of the objections that Kronecker put forward. He said Cantor is he's corrupting the whole of this system, and you can't build mathematics on an object which you can barely define. It's not a suitable basis. It's not a reality. But the mathematicians who wanted to get away from the creation loved it. They said, aha, here we've got our way to get away from the creation. And famous among them was a very well-known mathematician called David Hilbert. And he said, no one shall expel us from the paradise which Cantor has created for us. And he really jumped upon this basis for mathematics. And if you've got a mathematics which is built on a construct of a mathematician's thinking, there is no corresponding thing in reality to infinity. It's a mathematical limit. You are building your mathematics on something which doesn't have to correspond with reality at all. And mathematicians have really gone this route and said, that's the way we want to be. And Hilbert was typical of mathematicians who believed that mathematics could give all the answers. And he said, we must know. We shall know. Now, his desire, his claim, we shall know, was dealt a blow. Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. You will be able to put forward your mathematics, which tells you everything without reference to God and his creation. Well, that was actually shattered by a mathematician called Gödel, and he produced a theorem called the incompleteness theorem, which proves that any kind of mathematics will always produce propositions that cannot be shown to be true or false. You can always get answers which you can never know if they are true or false. Mathematics itself cannot tell you. The mathematician will have to decide between these results, because the mathematics itself cannot tell you which results are true. Now, there was one mathematician who stayed apart from this discussion. He was a Christian and he considered it absolute nonsense. He considered these people were just wasting their time looking for stupid things which were of no relevance. And he stuck to mathematics which dealt with the reality. And he produced mathematics, which is useful to people like me who use mathematics in our work. He worked on matrices, solutions of systems of equations, that kind of thing, things which actually have value in the real world. And the other mathematicians considered he was dealing with elementary mathematics. Elementary mathematics, that's the stuff that just deals with the normal stuff around us. Real mathematics, that deals with the fantasies in the mind of mathematicians. That takes mathematics to its utter limits. That's where the real creativity is. And Dodgson had a very low opinion of such mathematicians. And when he'd written a book for children, it was called Alice in Wonderland, he wrote a similar book, but this time for mathematicians and scientists. And he makes fun of them and points out what they are, you know, this is what you're doing. Can't you see it's all stupid? And through the looking glass, everything is back to front. Everything's front to back. Everything's the wrong way around. And he was pointing here at this new mathematics where everything is back to front. You start with the scatterbrained ideas of a mathematician and then see what it produces. And is it in any way connected with reality? And he portrays a great deal to do with mathematics and with the academic community in this book. But in particular, he has two, shall we say, stereotype mathematicians. And the first one is the authoritarian one that knows it all, somebody like Rutherford. And Alice is surprised by something this Red Queen says. But a hill can't be a valley, you know. That would be nonsense. Now, anybody skilled with the present mathematics immediately says, oh, yes, it's just a simple transformation. But to someone who's dealing with the real world, a hill cannot be a valley. Now, this mathematician says, you may call it nonsense if you like. I've heard nonsense compared with which that would be as sensible as a dictionary. And the other character, the absent-minded professor type of mathematician, says something which is plainly unbelievable. It can't be true. And Alice says, one can't believe impossible things. And the Queen says, oh, I dare say you haven't had much practice. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. Well, I just want to illustrate in a very simple way some of the problems that these mathematicians have been pointing out. We look at a very simple problem. Now, this is to do with reality. You want to make a square sandpit for your children, and you want the area to be 9 square meters. How big should you make it? Well, there's a very simple equation to this. You say the length of the sides must be L, and the area is length times length, which is L squared. So L squared equals 9. L is therefore the square root of 9, which is 3 or minus 3. Both 3 and minus 3, when squared, will give 9. 3 times 3 is 9. Minus 3 times minus 3 is 9. So both of these are valid answers. But you look at it and you say, aha, it needs to be 3 meters. It's obvious that it can't be minus 3 meters. You know minus 3 meters, you can't measure it. It's not there. The mathematics doesn't tell you that solution is wrong. The mathematics doesn't tell you that minus 3 is a nonsense solution. Your intellect and your knowledge of the reality tells you minus 3 is, well, it's produced by the mathematics, but it's not a useful solution. So here is a very simple example of Gödel's theorem. We have a proposition here. The length can be 3. The length can be minus 3. Mathematics cannot tell you which is true, which is false. You have to decide, based on your knowledge of the reality that this mathematics is describing. Now, if we can go a little bit more complex. Now, this is a little bit, needs a little bit more concentration. So a boy spends his pocket money on a ticket for a ball game. And while walking to the game, he sees a notice on a coffee shop. Wash dishes for tea hours and I will pay you 40 squared plus 3 tea plus $2. And he's intrigued and he works this out and says, well, if I wash dishes for 5 hours, I would get $117. And then he thinks, but you know, I'm early for my game of pop, at the ball game. I'm early. I really would like some popcorn. And at this rate, surely it wouldn't take me long to earn a dollar to get some popcorn. So he says, well, let's just work it out, because he's done a solution of quadratic equations at school, and that he remembers that an equation ax squared plus bx plus c is naught has a standard solution. Its x is minus b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. Now, I'm sure many of you were a long time ago at school, and you may not remember that, but many people remember that for the rest of their life. So he thinks, well, how long is it going to take me to make a dollar so I can get some popcorn to take to the game? And he just has to solve that equation, and he goes through the equation, and t is then minus a half plus or minus root 7 over 2, which is minus a half plus or minus root 7 times the root of minus 1 over 2. Now, he's heard that the square root of minus 1 is called I. It's called I, the imaginary number. Why is it called the imaginary number? Because nobody can imagine what it might be. Now, mathematically, you can give a meaning to it, but in the Earth or in this system around us, is there a meaning for it? Well, actually, no. It can be useful in mathematics, but for reality, this solution is no good to him. It says he's got to work for minus half an hour plus 1.3 imaginary hours. What does this mean? Could it mean if you take 0.5, if you take 0.5 real hours away from 1.3 imaginary hours, you've got to work for 0.8 imaginary hours? Well, 0.8 is about 50 minutes. So he goes to the owner of the shop and he says, I noticed your notice. I imagined working for 50 minutes. So you owe me a dollar. Well, what does the owner say? I'll pay you one imaginary dollar. Now, it's not so easy to see here what's the problem. But actually, the problem, you're getting nonsense out of it, because that equation of how much he pays you doesn't allow you to earn less than a dollar. It doesn't allow you to earn less than $2. Because if you put zero into the T, 0 hours plus 0 hours plus $2 is what you get for 0 hours. So you cannot get a solution out of it. But does the mathematics tell you? No, he's got these answers. They look like nonsense, but why? You have to look at it and find out, where did this answer, wrong answer come from? But you have to know the answer is nonsense before you can look for the problem. Now, you may call it nonsense if you like, but I've heard nonsense compared with which that would be as sensible as a dictionary. Well, let's look at such an example. Einstein said, there is no more commonplace statement than that the world we live in is a four-dimensional space-time continuum. To a mathematician, well, that's obvious. No question. Now, most people might think, what is a space-time continuum? It's four-dimensional. What are those four dimensions? Well, let's look at those four dimensions. One is length. Well, we know what length is. One is breadth. We know what breadth is. One is height. And the fourth dimension, imaginary time multiplied by the speed of light. Now, this certainly makes what Alice was talking about sensible as a dictionary compared to this nonsense. Imaginary time multiplied by the speed of light. No wonder Einstein's mathematics gives rubbish answers. Why does everybody accept it? Well, look, on Cantor's basis for mathematics, anything goes. This is perfectly sensible to a modern mathematician. He's basing his whole project on the figment of a mathematician's imagination. It's all based on infinity, which is not a real concept. It's a figment of the mathematician's imagination. We've got a problem here. If we do some calculations in this four-dimensional space-time, we get some answers. Are we in any position to tell which, if any of those answers are meaningful? Are any of them meaningful? Are they all meaningful? What the mathematician does is he says, the mathematics is correct. All those answers are true. Because within itself, mathematics has no way of telling which of its propositions are true, which are false. So the mathematician chooses he's going to believe them all. And Lewis Carroll, Charles Dodgson, was really pointing fun at mathematics, this kind of thing we've been looking at, where he had this mathematics professor, the absent-minded Professor Queen, saying, well, I dare say you haven't had much practice. I've sometimes believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. That is the way mathematics has gone. What went wrong in science is that accepted this. Mathematics was always the best tool the scientist had in his toolbox. Now, the tools you use, you choose them and you see that they're right fit for purpose. If they give answers which are meaningless, you reject it. But if you have made it the master, if this is the directing influence on your search, what hope have you for your mathematics, for your science? Now, people have been pointing out that this is the wrong way to go for a long time. Frederick Soddy was a very famous Nobel Prize winner, and he gave an address to the Nobel Prize winners of 1954, and he was very concerned about this, and he used most of his address to point out the folly of accepting what the mathematicians are saying instead of using scientific reasoning. And he said, while there is no objection urged against mathematicians doing whatever seems good to them in their own sphere, quite definitely they should be stopped from presenting their whims as science, let alone pretending that in the last analysis, they are the real scientists. But in spite of warnings like this, this is exactly what has happened. Now, Professor Brian G. Wallace was a physicist, and he was really concerned about this. He was dealing with things that are usually dealt with by relativity, and he found it gives totally wrong answers, and he was amazed that invalid mathematics had taken over science, and he wrote a book. Now, he only dared write this book when he knew he was dying, because the scientific mafia would have thrown him out. They would have dismissed him from his job and made sure he never got another one. But he knew he was dying, so he wrote this book, and he put it on the internet. It's free. You can go and download it. It's a very good book. It's called The Farce of Physics. And it's an easy read to book. It's an easy book to read. The word scientist entered the English language in 1840, and few individuals earned a living doing research, with most of the investigations carried out by gentlemen of wealth and leisure. At that time, a handful of American scientists were taking steps to transform the status and image and separate themselves as professionals from those they considered amateurs. The major tactic used to create this artificial separation has been the elaborate use of technical jargon and complex mathematics. This erection of higher and higher barriers to the comprehension of scientific affairs is a threat to an essential characteristic of science, its openness to outside examination and appraisal. And because of this, modern theoretical physics has become to a large degree little more than an elaborate farce. And it's not just in physics. He's talking about the farce of physics. If he had been in another discipline, he could easily have talked about the farce of other branches of science. Why? Because science has demanded ever higher levels of science, of mathematics, to separate them from the public, to increase their status. Everybody looks up to scientists because, wow, you know, this is difficult stuff. They must be very clever. And to them, the more complex the mathematics, the better. The more you will be revered, the harder the mathematics to understand. That's just what the scientific establishment wants. And the fact that this mathematics has no real bearing on reality doesn't worry them at all. Now, there have been scientists for a long time who've realized that science is going in the wrong direction. As science was taken over from the Christians, and taken over by secular humanists, everything started going wrong. Now, Henry Dale was a very fine scientist, a Nobel Prize winner, and you can see in what he says here, he realizes something is going wrong and we need to be careful. He said, and science, we should insist, better than any other discipline can hold up to its students and followers an ideal of patient devotion to the search for objective truth. With vision unclouded by personal or political motive, not tolerating any lapse from precision or neglect of any anomaly, fearing only prejudice and preconception, accepting nature's answers humbly and with courage, and giving them to the world with an unflinching fidelity. The world cannot afford to lose such a contribution to the moral framework of its civilization. But he can see that there is a threat to this, and it's on its way. Now, he was one of the last of the scientists who was immersed in the Christian worldview, and his position has been taken over completely by members of the scientific establishment like Lewontin. Now, Lewontin made a statement about science, and I'd like you to compare what Lewontin said with what Dale said. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, don't you? In spite of its failure to fill many of its extravagant promises of health and life. In spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. Because we have a prior commitment. A commitment to materialism. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive. no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Were these two men talking about the same thing? Dale was talking about a search for objective truth. Dale was talking about not accepting any anomalies. Here we've got a scientific community accepting unsubstantiated just so stories. Why? Because they're committed to not allowing a divine foot in the door. Now, all the old textbooks on science used to start off with an introduction, and the first thing it said is, science is that branch of the search of knowledge which follows the scientific method. And my textbooks from the 1950s, 60s, even the 70s, almost all of them began with an introduction that included this. Science is the branch of is that branch of the search of knowledge which follows the scientific method. Now, when the scientific establishment took over, I think there was a big change. This stopped being in the introduction, and in fact there was a move to put the mockers on the scientific method, say it's not necessary for science. And the later textbooks, they have a different introduction. They say it's very difficult to decide to define science. And they waffle on a little bit about why it's difficult to define it, and they end up saying something like, science is what scientists do. Is that a satisfactory definition of science? Scientists go to the toilet. Is that science? Scientists often tell lies. Is that science? But this is what has replaced the introduction to science books. Instead of being science is ruled by the scientific method, it's what scientists do. Now, you can now find a definition of what science is. Thomas Kuhn was one of the greatest philosophers of science, and he came to the conclusion that nowadays a proposition is scientific if it is sanctioned by the scientific establishment. Now, what does it mean to be sanctioned by the scientific establishment? It means if it is published in one of the journals that the scientific establishment sanctions. If they sanction a journal, it has to fit in with what they require. There are certain taboos that they demand. For example, there must be no criticism of evolution. There must be no criticism of Einstein. There must be no hint of a young age for the universe. It must be billions of years old. There are these holy cows which may not be touched. And if your paper that you submit conforms to all their requirements, then it's accepted, and the university that you work for will be given money. And the universities like this. They insist that their staff publish all their research in one of these established journals because the university needs the funding. And there's now the definition. What is science is what's published here, and what is published here is science. If it's not published here, it's not science. Now, there are a number of these journals. The very top ones are Nature and Science. And if you get something published here, this is real science. It's the top of the road. For example, a few years ago, Joseph Haffili and Richard Keating carried some atomic clocks around the world in an aeroplane. They took readings on these atomic clocks, published a paper, and that paper said their work substantiated Einstein. It proved Einstein was right. And they were really very well celebrated for this. I think they got a Nobel Prize for it, certainly professorships. Now, there was a problem for that because the man who knows more about time measurement than anybody else in the world is Louis Essen. Now, he has been called the Lord of Time. He invented the atomic clock. He knows more about the atomic clock than anybody else in the world. And when he looked at their paper, he said, it's impossible that the atomic clock can give these results. But science wouldn't publish. None of the other scientific journals sanctioned by the scientific authorities would. No one would publish the refutation of that paper from the highest expert on time measurement in the world. It's just not allowed to criticize Einstein or any paper they've published which supports Einstein. Now, eventually, he published his paper in CRSQ. And that is not a sanctioned journal. It's not accepted by the scientific establishment. It's a very good journal, but you get no money for publishing there, and you're certainly encouraged not to. And if you publish in something like this, you will lose your status as a scientist. Now, CRSQ is not a establishment sanctioned journal, but there are lots of people who read it because there's good stuff in there. And Dr. A.G. Kelly, reading this, decided to take a closer look and got the original data, and he published a paper, not in one of the sanctioned journals, of course. And this is his abstract. He says, the original test results were not published by Hafili and Keating in their famous 1972 paper. They published figures which were radically different from the actual test results, which are here published for the first time. An analysis of the real data shows that no credence can be given to the conclusions of Hafili and Keating. That stuff was a fraud, and the sanctioned journals refuse to allow any paper which shows it was a fraud. But papers like this have become fairly well known, and they have now put on a campaign to claim that those results were valid and they have been substantiated. You can believe that if you want. I don't. There is nobody who has more authority on time measuring and what you can do with an atomic clock than Louis Essen. Now, Brian Wallace took up Kuhn's definition of what science is. A proposition is scientific, it is sanctioned by the scientific establishment. Example, if the scientific establishment decrees that fairies exist, then this would be scientific indeed. Now, do you think that sounds far-fetched? Not at all. Not at all. One of the scientific establishment's top people was Carl Sagan. Perhaps you've been indoctrinated by his Cosmos series. One of the top members of the scientific establishment. Now, he published a book on comets. Comets are a big problem for the long time scale, because comets like Ikiyoseki, Halley's Comet, they lose tons of material every second when they're near enough to the sun to evaporate the material off and throw it out into space. And these things are only about 10 kilometers in diameter and losing many tons every second. They can't last very long, and it's been shown that they, but a short period comet cannot possibly last longer than 10,000 years. Problem. We've still got short period comets. The creation must be less than 10,000 years old. Oh my, how do we get over this? Well, we imagine a source of comets. Now, the chap who imagined this source of comets was called Oort, so it's now called the Oort cloud. And in his imagination, he had this huge cloud of trillions of comets out there. And they're so far away, you can't see them, and they're out of the solar system. But every now and again, a dark star, which you can't see, comes by, and it disturbs some of these comets in the orbit. So now they move in towards the center of the solar system, and that's where the short period comets come from. Now, it's interesting to see, here's Carl Sagan, he's putting forward this in his book, Comet, this is the solution to the problem. He says many scientific papers are written each year about the Oort cloud, its origin, its properties, its evolution. Yet there is not a shred of observational evidence for its existence. How can you make any measurements on something for which there's not the slightest shadow of evidence? If you can't make any measurements, how can this be scientific? You have to make observations and measurements, and these can't be detected in any way. How can this be science? Oh, well, it's science because, you see, it's published in the journals of the accepted scientific establishment. That makes it scientific. There's not the slightest shred of evidence for existence. What is the difference between that and fairies? The only difference is that at least some people have claimed to see fairies. Nobody's claimed to see these things. Now, the extent of the fall of science into ridiculousness is illustrated here in a paper published in Nature. Remember the two very top journals of science, Nature and Science. And this was published by three very famous American astronomers, Denison, Fiedler and Johnson. And in this paper, they put forward explanations for observations they'd made of a quasar. Now, this quasar, for some reason or other, it had been in their telescope for a long time, and then all of a sudden it started to disappear. It's disappearing here. It had looked like that, now it's looking like this, and then a few days later it's almost disappeared. But then after a while, it went the other way, it started to come back again. And then a week or so later, here we are, it's back just as it was. So they wrote their paper on this thing disappearing behind what they called an extreme scattering event structure, an ESE structure. And they have this structure and they put it together from elementary particles and atoms falling in this cloud, and this cloud slowly drifts in front of the quasar, and then it drifts out of the way, and that explains why they saw this. Now, this paper was reviewed by Gerrit Elfeskier in astronomy, and he put forward this paper, and he said, the most intriguing thing about the hypothesized structures, these extreme scattering event structures, a point that the authors of the report hesitated to emphasize, but did allude to, is that these objects are not stable. If such an object could exist for even a moment, it would quickly dissipate. What's this? If you could push these things together as they say, in a moment it would all disappear. In that case, how on earth can it explain an observation that went on over 2 weeks? This is utter and complete nonsense. So does he say, why do we allow people to tell such nonsense in the top journals of science? Well, let's see what he says. He says, they could either attempt to explain the radio brightness change and ignore the stability problem, in which case they'd have no paper to write, they would get no more prestige, they'd get no money for their university, or they could confront the stability issue and be unable to explain the radio variations and not be able to write anything to get published. So now, look at these frauds. They are writing stuff they know perfectly well to be rubbish, just so that they can get these papers published. These people ought to be thrown out. Does he say that? No, he says, like all good scientists, they're prepared to tolerate the ambiguities in their model. This is science. Science is absolutely full of papers like this. But now, if you present this to a scientist, I've done this often, scientists look and say, oh, but look, this is more than 5 years old. You can't accept a paper that's more than 5 years old. Why not? You can look at Euler's papers, more than 200 years old. Every one of them is now as valid as it was then. It's as useful, it's as correct. You look at Newton's original stuff, valid as it ever was. Look at all the science done by those Christian pioneers. Look at Maxwell's work, as valid as it ever was. People are still using his radio, his radios and his microwaves, the things that come out of his theories. But today, 5 years, scrap it. It's not true, it's rubbish. This is throwaway science. This never was useful to anybody. It never will be. Throw it out. You can't put this forward. It's more than 5 years old. Science has descended to the point of being throwaway nonsense. And anybody who tries to go against this and point out problems that the scientific establishment don't like, they get thrown out. Now, this is a documentary that was done by Ben Stein. It was in the cinemas maybe about 10 years ago. I think you can still buy the DVD, in which he looks at all the people who get thrown out if they dare to say something the scientific establishment doesn't like. And there are three things that happen. First of all, they lose their job. Secondly, the scientific establishment makes sure that the universities which issued them their degrees, their masters, their PhD, rescind those qualifications, annul them, and they're no longer valid. That's the power that the scientific establishment has. And it makes sure that the people involved are never allowed to publish, and they're certainly not allowed to receive things like Nobel Prizes. Robert Gentry, for example, he's an expert on one of the fields of radiometric dating called radio halo analysis. He published a little book on his research called Creation's Tiny Mystery, in which he pointed out that the observations of these things show that the Earth must have been created very quickly, definitely not over billions of years. He was thrown out of his job. He couldn't get another one because the scientific establishment made sure that couldn't happen. He's out of the way. Now, Halton Arp was one of the top 20 astronomers in the world. And he was an astronomer at a prestigious university working on the biggest telescope in the world. And he started finding in his research and publishing the results that the redshifts in stars show that the distances that the astronomers are all talking about are wrong, because redshifts are not to do with distance. And that means the expanding universe story is wrong, which puts paid to the Big Bang theory, and that is not allowed by the scientific establishment. He was banned from using telescopes. Now, an astronomer cannot do any research if he can't get on a telescope. If he can't do any research, he can't publish any papers. He can't do any science. And so he had to resign. And from being in the top 20 in the world, he became a nobody, because he went against the scientific establishment. But he published a book. That book is called Seeing Red. It's about the redshifts, about cosmology. And he also talks about academic science, meaning he talks about the scientific establishment, which has often been called the scientific mafia. They have enormous power. Now, Fred Hoyle was one of the greatest scientists of the last 100 years, and his work was amazing. He did amazing work, including some astounding work on the carbon atom. And his theoretical work showed that the carbon atom had to have some very special properties, some very special energy level capabilities. And being a real scientist, he wasn't prepared to just put forward the theory. He wanted to prove it, see if it was right or wrong. And the apparatus to prove whether it was right or wrong was the linear accelerator in America, which was under the direction of William Fowler. So Hoyle went to Fowler and said, look, here's my theory. I need to prove it. This is the experiment that I need done, which will verify or falsify it. This will prove whether it's true or not. Will you do it? And William Fowler looked at this and said, this is crazy. There can't be things we don't know about in the carbon atom. You know, there aren't any other atoms that have this feature. It must be wrong. I'm not going to waste my time doing it. But Hoyle was very persistent, and he kept going back and back and insisting. And eventually Fowler said, well, how can I get this fellow off my back? I'll do it just to get rid of him. He did the experiment, and lo and behold, wow, this theory is true. It really is like that. And this was so astounding, it obviously had to get a Nobel Prize. But Hoyle took a stand which the establishment didn't like. He started looking at evolution and came to the conclusion, hey, this cannot be possible. And looking at the structure of the universe, he said, altogether, there is only one way that this can have come about. It needed an intelligence to create it, both living and non-living material. The way it is organized, it must have had an intelligent creator. He got thrown out by the scientific establishment. He was head of astronomy at Cambridge University. They chucked him out of that and made sure that he couldn't get another job anywhere. And instead of that Nobel Prize going to Fred Hoyle, it went to William Fowler. Why has all this happened? Science has been taken over by an establishment which cannot allow a divine foot in the door, and it doesn't matter what the price. It doesn't matter if it costs science as a worthwhile discipline. They cannot allow a divine foot in the door. And that is what went wrong with science.